We're thankful for those of you who are visiting with us this evening, and we're thankful, as David has expressed, for the safe return of Ken and Karen and their family, and pray for the safe return of our young people as they depart before too many more days to go back to their school work. In our studies, we are continuing to discuss the history and geography of the Bible, and let me once again reiterate that we are basically preparing an outline that's going to be very important as our studies continue to develop down the pike just a little bit. We're talking about the geographical locations just to get a fix in our mind of where we are talking about. We're going to begin, before too many more pages in our lesson book, to talk in some detail about the events that occurred in some of these geographic locations that make them very, very significant to our study. Also, before we get into our study this evening, I want to express my appreciation to Richard. I've kind of razzed him a bit about the quality of our projector and what you see on the screen and the distinction in colors, and Richard has researched, and now we have something that presents for us the distinction of colors that's going to be especially helpful, I think, as our studies progress and we look at the travels of various individuals that are going to be the subjects of our study. In our last study, we talked about the New Testament lands. Richard, while I was away, had talked with you about the Greeks. We began last Lord's Day morning talking about the Roman entity and the reason for its conquering of the land of Canaan, the strategic location of the land of Canaan, and the commerce, the trade that Rome controlled as it desired to control the entire Mediterranean Sea area. We also want to speak just briefly. We were on this chart as we ran out of time Sunday morning regarding the Jews in this period of the Roman entity. Now, one of the things that we did comment on in our study Sunday was from Daniel chapter 2, how that Daniel had prophesied a sequence of kingdoms, beginning with King Nebuchadnezzar, the king of the Babylonian Empire, and that from King Nebuchadnezzar there would develop a sequence of four kingdoms, including King Nebuchadnezzar's empire, and during the days of these kings, that is, the days of the kings of that fourth world empire, the God of heaven would set up his kingdom, which shall never be destroyed, nor shall the sovereignty thereof be left unto another people, but it shall break in pieces all these, it will consume them, and stand forever. Now, as we began the study of the New Testament, we noted that we are discussing the period of the Roman Caesars. We talked about how that they came into power. Let me back up just a chart or two very quickly. One in particular I'm looking for. I'll buzz through these. Well, the easiest way to do that is, I suppose, this. What I wanted you to see is that as the Old Testament prophet pointed to a period identified as the last days, Daniel chapter 2, beginning about verse 16, that Daniel is prophesying the establishment of the Lord's kingdom. And as we come into the days of the Roman entity, we saw that Pompey enters Jerusalem about 63 B.C. We find that Spain is invaded. Pompey is defeated and fled to Egypt, where eventually he's killed. But then we also noted that Julius Caesar moves to Egypt, and Cleopatra is made ruler of Egypt, and the events began to transpire as we see the conquering of this little country, the land of Canaan. And that was the point I was wanting, right? There. Octavian declared the first Roman emperor titled Augustus Caesar as we began our study of the New Testament in Luke chapter 2 and in verse 1. Now, as we have everything in place, the Roman Empire in place, we have the contributions that Rome made to the spreading of the gospel. We noted as we concluded our study that Galatians chapter 4 declares that in the fullness of times, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, that He might redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. The significance of this time, the fullness of times. Not only do we see the development of travel by Rome, we also see a centralized governmental figure that controls the commerce of the world, but it also provided an opportunity for Jews to be located all over the Roman Empire. Now, the thing that makes that significant to us today, or for our study, is that wherever the Apostle Paul went, for the most part, in his three preaching tours, where did he go first? Synagogue of the Jews. Now, we find one exception to that, of course, in the city of Philippi, where there were some women that were meeting down by the riverside. But the point is, there were groups of Jews that were located all over the known world. This is especially, I think, seen in Acts chapter 2, when you begin to read of the outpouring of the Holy Spirit upon that first Pentecost following the resurrection of Christ. Where were these Jews from? Look at the text of Acts chapter 2. We have Jews that have come from the reaches of the known world. In verse 5 it says, "Now there were dwelling at Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. And when this sound was heard, the multitude came together and were confounded, because that every man heard them speaking in his own language. And they were all amazed and marveled, saying, Behold, are not all these that speak Galileans? And how hear we, every man, in our own language wherein we were born? Parthians and Medes and Elamites, and the dwellers in Mesopotamia, in Judea and Cappadocia and Pontus and Asia and Phrygia and Pamphylia and Egypt and parts of Libya and Cyrene, and sojourners from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabians. How hear we them speaking speaking in our own tongues the mighty works of God?" Now this map, as you can see from where you are, isn't that impressive? When you talk about those from Rome and those from the Mesopotamian Valley, as you'll read the identification of these places, the Elamites, those in Judea and Cappadocia and Pontus and Asia. Here's Asia up in this area. You've got folks all around the Mediterranean Sea that are gathered in the city of Jerusalem to observe these feast days. Flag goes up. Jews were scattered. And when you read in Acts chapter 8 in verse 4 regarding the persecution of the church that became so intense at the hand of Saul of Tarsus, verse 4 tells us that the disciples were scattered abroad. Well, what did that do for the spreading of the gospel? It began here in Jerusalem, then Judea, Samaria, and then, of course, we have the gospel preached in Antioch, where we read of the preaching tours, not yet to Spain, but the preaching tours of the Apostle Paul that wind up with him being in Italy. And we've read in Romans 15 where his expressed desire was to go to Spain. And that's just the travels of one of the apostles. So our point is, when we look at the geography during New Testament times, travel was a crucial element in the spreading of the gospel. And when Paul preached in the synagogue of the Jews, he had an audience that supposedly was knowledgeable of the Scriptures, should be, to the extent that he could establish who Jesus is. Now, all of that together is just, again, laying a foundation that we want to build upon. Now, I ask you to, as we concluded our study last time, to be sure that you have filled out your lesson sheet on page 27 and 28 for lessons 6 and 7 as we review the Old and New Testament lands. Now, one of the things, Richard, I appreciate so much the good work you've done in preparing this projector for us so we can use it tonight. But in the maps that we are using tonight, you'll notice that they are black and white maps. You can fix that. Yes, sir, right now. No. Well, that's fixable. That's doable. Oh, no, not necessary. These are from the Thetford slides. But as we look at these maps, the point is to review the questions. Look at number one on page 27. Number one on page 27. I'm going to have to issue, I guess, one of these laser pointers to everyone in the audience so that you can point and locate these things on the map. But in answer to number one, an early nation in Asia Minor. Lynn, what would that be? The Hittites. That's right, the Hittite kingdom. Now, there was a long time that people believed, scholars did not believe that the Bible was accurate in referencing the Hittite people because they did not have any archaeological findings to affirm that the Hittites really existed. But, of course, then it was discovered that they did exist, and the location is here in Asia Minor. Number two, Israelites wandered here after they left Egypt. Betty Jo, number two. The wilderness of Sinai. Now, I want you to look at your map up here on the board because this black and white is going to be real important as we continue to develop in our minds the locations of these places. You remember the C that I sometimes make when we're talking about places, and here is the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea, the Red Sea down here, Egypt over here, the Nile River here, and of course this little peninsula, Betty, is what you've just described, the Sinai Peninsula. When they came up out of the land of Egypt, they crossed over the Red Sea into the Sinai Peninsula, where they wandered for how long? All right, for 40 long years. I don't know why we say it that way. A year is long, but these were 40 long years. They took about 2 years, Jenny, to make the trip down to Sinai and then up to Kadesh Barnea, where they sent in the spies and did not go in as they had been instructed to. And so consequently, we've got 38 more years in the wilderness of Sinai, where God provided for them and they learned dependence upon God. So I want you to picture this little peninsula so you'll be able to readily recognize that on any of the maps that we use. Number three, the entire history of the Old Testament takes place here. Richard talked with you about this in some detail as he talked about the Old Testament lands. What is this area identified as where the Old Testament history takes place? Joey? The Fertile Crescent. That's right. The Fertile Crescent. Why do you suppose it's called that? I tell you, head like that belongs in Congress. We have these two rivers, the River Euphrates and the Tigris River, and of course here's Canaan. What do we have here? All right, the Arabian Desert. So nothing in particular is productive there. So that makes this little stretch of land, as we've tried to emphasize in most of our studies, so very crucial to the control of the commerce around the Mediterranean Sea. The Ark rested here. Donna, number four, Mount Ararat. Yes, Mount Ararat. We don't know exactly where, but that's the location. Number five, the location of summer, Babylon, and probably the Garden of Eden. Number five. Chris? Mesopotamia. Yes, Mesopotamia. And of course, this is the area primarily between the Tigris and the Euphrates River. Tigris and Euphrates empty into it. What is it that the Tigris and Euphrates empty into, Bruce? You may have traveled in this part of the country. Some of you probably have. The Persian Gulf. That's right. They empty into the Persian Gulf. And then number seven, the longest river in the world. The longest river in the world. David? The Nile River. Yes. How long is it? I cheated. 4,100 miles. Richard and I were talking today as we both have done some study on the history of the River Nile as to where it originates. You might find that to be a fascinating study. It's really even now unknown precisely where the River Nile originates because of the many tributaries that make up the River Nile. In fact, there are two major lakes, I guess you would say, that contribute to the Nile, the White Lake and the Blue Lake, and you can research that on your own as to why they're called that. But even those lakes have numerous tributaries to them, so it's still somewhat mysterious as to the precise beginning of the Nile River. So you can see how, David, over such a long distance and so many fingers contributing to the Nile, how that those of the Egyptians would consider the River Nile the gift of the gods, or refer to Egypt as the gift of the gods. Number seven, this empire was in power during the ministry of Christ. John, the Roman Empire. And of course, we have that simply labeled on our map here, but what I want you to see is that it controlled the commerce around the Mediterranean Sea. Okay? Our next question, number nine, the home of the descendants of Aram, the son of Shem, son of Noah. Where did they originate? Number nine. Ken? Anyone? Help him out just a little. Aram, number eight. All right. Number eight. All right, that puts us on the map. Number 10, the region on the northern shores of the Mediterranean Sea. That's an easy one for us. Randy? Asia Minor, yes. Asia Minor. And you'll recognize that as this projectile. What's this, by the way? Cyprus, all right, just north of Cyprus. And, of course, up in this area we have Antioch, and the beginning of Paul's travels up into Asia Minor. Number 11, the region where hieroglyphics originated. Lynn? Number 9, Egypt. That's right. The largest body of water in Bible lands. Carolyn? Mediterranean Sea. Yes, the Mediterranean Sea. And, of course, that becomes the focal point of our studies as far as the map is concerned. The home of many nomadic tribesmen and traders, number 13. Julie. Uh-huh. Very good. Arabia. You did good, Julie. Arabia. That's right. And we see that on this map. Number 14. Mesopotamia, is the land between these two rivers. Pardon me? All right, go for it. The Euphrates and the Tigris. That's right. Very good. Number 16, the empire led by Alexander the Great. Carolyn, Alexander the Great. Greece. Yeah, Greece. Now, in our study of the book of Acts, those of you that have been with us in that study, those of you that have been with us in our authority study as well, know that Greece is also called, in our New Testament study, we have talked about Corinth being one of the prominent cities in Achaia. So I want you to equate these two, Greece and Achaia. Okay? And then number 17, the two arms of the Red Sea. Anyone? Suez, that's right. By the way, you might like to do some work on the Suez Canal, not just from the standpoint of a political thing, but from the standpoint of our geography study, where that canal is located, what it does, and why it is, where it is, and how long it is, and things like that. So, yes, the Gulf of Aqaba and the Gulf of Suez. Number 19 in our lesson, the place where cuneiform writing began. Donna? Mesopotamia. Yes, very good. And then the Mediterranean island nearest Palestine. Chris? Cyprus. That's right. And, of course, that's where Paul first went on the first preaching tour in Acts chapter 13 after he left Antioch on his beginning of the first preaching tour. Yes? The answer to number 5 is also Mesopotamia, yes. That's correct. That's correct. Okay. Number 21. The original home of the Philistines. Rick? Crete. Very good. The island of Crete. And you'll see that right over there. The island of Crete. Number 22. Another name for Aram-Nehara. One more time. Do it for me. Naharim. My mouth won't say that. Another name for it. Richard, tell me.
Mesopotamia.
Isn't that so much more easy to pronounce? Yes. Number 23. Opens into the Indian Ocean. The Indian Ocean. John? Red Sea. Very good. The Red Sea. And then number 24. The gift of the Nile is anyone? Egypt. All right. Egypt. And then number 25. Often referred to in Old Testament history as the Great River, the Euphrates. Where would be at least one? There are a number of times, but where would I read it referred to as the Great River? Pardon me? A little farther. 15. Yes, Genesis 15. Very good. Pardon me? You like that better, huh? Okay. All this high-tech stuff. Anyhow. All right. Another look at the Bible lands. I want you to see this one in color. Here's, of course, Egypt, the land of Canaan, Asia Minor, and you've got the places located then and can see them, I'm guessing, about as clearly on this as you can your lesson book. Somewhat so? Good. Good. You did good. Yes, you did very good. Thank you. All right. Any questions or comments just here before we look at lesson number 8? Wrong one. Yes, sir. Well, it is small. Let me get the map back up here. Just to give you a point of comparison. Does this give you an idea? Here's the land of Canaan, and we know it's about 150 miles long. And here's the Sinai Peninsula. Yes.
I mean, when you really think about that, how could you not find your way out?
Well, I don't think that it's so much of a matter of being lost as such. But you've got 2 to 3 million people in a relatively small place, as it were, that is barren wilderness. What do you do with them? The reason they were there was not necessarily because they were lost, but because they had defied the instructions of God to go in and take the land. Now, when you consider that the land they are to take is just north here, they were right on the border of the land, but they did not go in, but there were people that lived there. That's the point. That's the point. Now, why do you suppose that Joshua and Caleb were so upset with them for not going in? Now, suppose they had changed their mind and says, okay, God, we'll do it. We'll do it now. What's the problem now? They did say that, yeah, but what was the problem with that? Too late. God was not with them. Now, a condition of their going in and taking the land was, I will be with you. I will fight your battles. That's what Joshua and Caleb assured them of. But they said, we are like grasshoppers in their sight. We can't do that. Now, changing your mind, it's too late. God was not with them. They had expressed their lack of faith. And the Hebrew writer tells us in Hebrews chapter 4, that God, the latter part of 3 and the first part of chapter 4, that God was not with them because of their unbelief. Well, you know, it's easy to say, well, yeah, we would straighten up if we saw what they saw. No, we wouldn't. You see, the very point of the Hebrew writer in Hebrews chapter 4 is to tell those Hebrews that they entered not in because of unbelief, and you'll not enter into heaven because of your unbelief. Now, that's the key to all of that. Yes, and it's a very good point to make an observation, David, that we're looking at an area that if you just go in one direction and keep going, you'll find the edge of the Sinai Peninsula. I mean, we've got the Gulf of Aqaba on one side, the Gulf of Suez on the other side. We've got the Mediterranean Sea to the north, north-northwest. And what do we have just northeast? The land of Canaan. But there are people there, and God will not fight their battles. What do you do? You wonder. And you subject yourself to the provisions of God, and you learn dependence upon God. And that's what they had to learn until a generation of them died.
Yeah, assuming Google Maps is correct, from the land of Goshen into the southern part of Israel, in a straight line, it's only about 150 miles. But there's plenty of
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of observations, I think, to be made on that when you consider that Jacob was not really all that far away from his son Joseph, about 200 miles, roughly, when you get on up into the area where Jacob was. But here's his son that he doesn't know exists for 22 years. Now, if you had a child that was less than 200 miles away and you knew they were alive, wouldn't you go search for them? You know, there's all kinds of things that this geography puts into perspective for us. So it's a legitimate question. Any other questions or comments? Anything further on that? That's an excellent observation. Well, certainly so. And, of course, when you look at the Arabian Desert and you've got an area where there is nomadic life, tradesmen and so forth, but you don't have 2 to 3 million in a group, what do you do with them? He did. Got in trouble, but yes. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Richard?
The thing is that, as you mentioned, it's not like they were lost. God was showing them where they needed to go. Mm-hmm. He would lead them by the pillar of fire at night or the pillar of cloud during the day. And where it went, they went.
Mm-hmm.
And when it stayed, they stayed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they were led all over the place.
And where they died, that's where they were buried. Because that's what God said would happen to them. Okay? Very good. All right. Dating Bible events, lesson number 8. Now, I hope that you haven't looked at lesson number 8 and say, oh, I can't remember all those dates. That's not what I'm asking you to do. You have the lesson book that is going to help you with some of that. But I want us to be familiar with Bible dates for a reason. Now, you'll note, if you'll look at page number 29 in your lesson book, Genesis chapter 5, and in verse 3, we learn that Adam was 130 years old when his son Seth was born. You'll also note that Seth was 105 when his son, the American Standard Translation spells it Enosh, was born. Now, if we take the figures of the 10 generations that are listed in Genesis chapter 4, or chapter 5 and chapter 6, 10 generations are listed. Adam, you'll see that. Seth, verse 6. Enosh, verse 9. And then Kenan, in verse 12 and so forth, down to Noah in verse 32. Noah lived 500 years, and Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now, totaling all this together, the 10 generations that are listed plus Noah's age when the flood began, that brings us to a number of 1,656 years. You say, now, Mick, why'd you say all that? Well, one is, our book says that. But I want you to be aware of it for this reason. There are those who think that we can take the number of years in the genealogical records and then combine all of that and date the day of creation. That's not our purpose, and that's not the purpose of this list of the 10 generations that are identified here. We might also note that 10 generations can be accounted for from Noah to Abraham when he left Ur, or left Haran, rather, on the way to Canaan. You can see that in Genesis chapter 12 and in verse 4. Now, again, when you look at these lists of generations, what is the purpose of the list of generations? To tell us precisely a number of years? It shows lineage. It shows lineage. Now, that's very, very important. It doesn't mean that we need to simply discount the numbers that are mentioned in these lists of genealogies, but not to see them as exact, because they are designed to show lineage. And when we're studying these things, I think it's important for us to try to help somebody to have somewhat of an understanding. When we're discussing the scheme of redemption, we're going to be talking about Genesis 3, the beginning. We're going to be talking about Genesis 12, Abraham. We're going to be talking about Genesis 6, the days of the flood. And it's helpful, I think, for us to see that there are about 10 generations that tell us from Genesis 3 to Genesis 6. About 10 generations more from Genesis 6 to Genesis 12. And not one word said in the interim there about the promise of God to save man. But these verses are not intended to give us a chronology of every event or every generation that lived during that particular period of time. And that's about all I want to say about that. But when we look at these genealogies, we can see that if you used these dates through this section of Scripture, you would have a system of dating, if you please, if you did not take into account any skipping of a generation. You could say, well, we've got the exact number of years. Well, using this method, it would place creation about 4,000 B.C. And we have to use the term about. But we're still not talking about eons of time. Now, that's something I want to just pause and have you think about for a moment. These genealogical records, though they are not given so that we can know the exact date of creation, it does give us somewhat of an understanding that the earth is relatively young, not old. Okay? Just wants to give that a little bit of thought. And as we use dating Bible events, as it's discussed in our lesson study, the name James Usher is going to be prominent because in the 1600s he used the biblical references plus historical facts at his disposal to begin to try to date certain Bible events. Now, the dating of Bible events this particular gentleman began in study helps of English Bibles about 1701. Now, you can see why that would be a study help. Not necessarily to assign an exact date to an event of history, but for our purposes to try to get them in some kind of order of events. Now, everybody with me? That's going to be important as we try to come up with some kind of chronology for the events that take place in the Bible. Now, James Usher's dating system is included in some Bibles, center reference columns or marginal reference references. Some of you may have some Bibles that include those dates that find their source with Mr. Usher. But what I want you not to do is to think that those dates are set in stone. Sometimes when we read a reference work, we come away and we say, well, you know, that's the exact date that occurred. In fact, I've taught lessons like this before, and we talk about a historical event, and I may use a different date than what someone else has found in a reference work, and they say, well, that's not what my Bible says. Now, you want to get Mick's ears perked up, you say that. My Bible doesn't say that. Well, where does your Bible say that? And you will say, right here in the center column reference. No, that's not inspired. James Usher's dating methods are not inspired. The dates are not inspired. But yet they are used in many of the Bibles that have been published in the last many years. Now, archaeological discoveries. Archaeological discoveries since Mr. Usher abound. And many of these discoveries, I think, are very helpful in dating events that Mr. Usher was not aware of. And so his dates have not necessarily been found to be true in every instance. In fact, in some instances, very much inaccurate. And so we want to simply note that in our passing. Now, that raises some questions. How can we cite any evidence of whether or not Mr. Usher's dating system was flawed or whether it was accurate? Now, those of you who have studied this before may have come across this bit of information. Mr. Usher dates the days of the flood at 2,349 B.C. Yet Ur of Chaldee was established after the flood. Archaeology shows that Ur was a thriving city some 3,500 years before Christ with no evidence of some kind of an interruption that would equal the proportions of a worldwide flood. Now, when we're trying to date things, why is that important? We know the Bible describes a universal flood. What's the difference that you might expect to find? Now think with me. What's the difference that you might expect to find in evidence of a universal flood versus a local flood? For example, when we look at the Nile River, we know that it flooded frequently. We can look at the Euphrates River, and we can see that it was not uncommon for there to be a local flood as a result of a great deal of rain in that period or in that location. But we're not talking about that kind of a flood that destroyed the world. Now, when we try to present evidence that there has been a universal flood, what's one of the evidences that we like to present? Yeah, you would expect to find that. John? Okay, all right. All right, that's right. So, go ahead, John. That's right. That's right. So, if Mr. Usher has his date correct, then when you would look at Ur, you would find the archaeological studies to reveal that here is a period of time where there was no major disruption. And when we span back through the archaeological studies, we've got about 3,500 years before Christ without such evidence. What does that tell us about the city of Ur? Was older than this, which tells us that Mr. Usher's dating system is not without flaw. Yeah. And how those were developed and changes that were made to them while they were in use, and why. That's all very fascinating. Now, when we think about time, time is a very relative thing, isn't it? Most of you who are still employed know what day it is. You know what time it is. You set your clock to get up at a certain time. Everything in your life is relative to time. Has to be so, or you'll miss something. Our lives rotate around our clocks and the calendar. Now, that means that the rest of the world feels just about like you do about that. We recognize some standard by which we date history. We assume that it's always been like that, but that's not necessarily so. The world has not always recognized the same calendar. And that presents all kinds of problems in our reckoning of time. Has not always been reckoned the same way. Our time is counted from the birth of Christ. But what about before Christ? Did they reckon time? Well, certainly they did. They had calendars, and they reckoned time in a variety of ways. When we look at the Sumerians, the Egyptians, the Israelites, the Greeks, and the Romans, just to name a few, there are different means of determining time. For example, the Romans, though observing lunar periods of time and so forth, much of their determination of time was how long has it been since the city of Rome was built. And so we start with the building of Rome and we date things from there. Well, now that's a wonderful thing if the rest of the world knows exactly when Rome was built. But what if you lived before Rome? The Greeks, they recognized a four-year cycle from one Olympics to the next. That's how they dated things. Now that's fine, well and good if you're well familiar with that. The Israelites, Their new year marked the day they left Egypt. I find that fascinating. Turn in your Bible to Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. If you were an Israelite, you would date things from when you came out of Egypt. Exodus chapter 12. In verse 2 it says, "And Jehovah spake unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, This month shall be unto you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak ye unto the congregation of Israel, saying, In the 10th day of this month they shall take to them every man a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household," and so forth and so on. But this marked the beginning of their calendar. You see further evidence of that in Numbers chapter 1. From the day you came out of Egypt, this is the beginning of your year. Now, that's how you would date things. Now, that would make things very easy if you were an Israelite. But you see, the length of time for the earth to circle the sun as we begin to get into solar year or calendar was something that people did not always calculate precisely. People could calculate the earth rotation of the sun by determining the seasons. But what do we know about the rotation of the earth and its relationship to the sun, even relative to seasons? In the calendar that you use, every once in a while there's a month of the year that's a little shorter than the others. And what's the purpose of that? Even out the year. That's right. Because our calendar isn't perfect. Our calendar isn't perfect. You see, some calendars, ancient calendars, had 10 months. Others had 12. Some were accurate. Some were not accurate at all. And so with these things existent within the calendars that were being used, there was a lack of consistency to date any particular event. I want you to drop down in your lesson book on page 29. And note that in paragraph 1, 2, 3 from the bottom, about the middle of that paragraph, it says, "An early Roman calendar had 10 months beginning in March. It seemed to have ignored 60 days in winter. Sometimes a Roman emperor added a month to his year on a mere whim. At other times, wise men would realize their calendar was incorrect because the seasons were no longer coming at the right time. So the ruler might declare that a certain number of days be added or subtracted to make up the difference. For example, Julius Caesar added 90 days to the year that would be 46 BC in our reckoning in an effort to correct the Roman calendar." Now, what would that do for you? If some political figure just decided our calendar is off and so we're just going to add 3 months to the year, so we'll make it come out even. Well, you see, that's what he did. And many calendars have been created and changed and altered and so forth throughout the years, which makes dating historical events difficult. Now, you multiply that times nationalities, and you multiply that times events in those political histories that marked benchmarks from which some things were dated. For example, during the reign of this king of this particular nation, this event happened. In the fourth year of the reign of this king, this particular event happened. Suppose you were not a part of that nationality. You didn't recognize that lineage of kings. Suppose you have kings that share the same name. And you see the complexity. And therefore you see the importance of chronology, trying to get events simply in order. Bible events. Thus the importance of our study. Appreciate your interest and participation in our